So I'm Rob Annex from the University of Wisconsin, and I'm the advisor of Jordy, who, if you were here for a couple of talks ago, you got to hear about the system that he's built. And as a faculty member, you know, the students get to do all the fun and the hard work. So he's fabricating and designing circuit boards and fabricating chambers and building trailers, and I'm going to committee meetings and faculty meetings and lectures. So occasionally, between in those little openings, I doodle around with things. So you get to be patient and hear. So I also sit next door to a guy who runs a big crew that goes out and does field sampling of static chambers. And I understand how difficult it is for him. So I started thinking about that, the question of how should we be smart about sampling in 2.0 and in doing it manually, because the box that Jordy told you about is like a $100,000 instrument. You start adding in pumps and valves and trailers and air conditioners, and well, we're going to keep doing manual sampling for a while, right? So let me think if I can't sort of help with that just a little bit. So I'm going to tell you about some little things I doodled with. So Professor Farrell, Dr. Farrell's lecture was an absolutely perfect introduction. So you guys probably all pretty much know how we do manual sampling. And it takes a pretty big crew if you're going to pull multiple samples from each collar over the course of 30, 45 minutes. To sample a large number, you have a pretty big crew, and you can only get out there so often. And we want to figure out how to sample intelligently. So I started thinking about that. So here's actually some of the data from this year that Jordy generated with that really cool, nearly continuous system. And if you're sampling really frequently, so what I've done here is the blue is the essentially continuous data, and it's average. He's averages 15-minute signals to give you a one day, right? So if you went out and sampled on that day at 10 in the morning or whatever, you'd get that blue line. And if you went out and sampled every 2 days, those red circles are where you sampled, and then if you linearly interpolate, the red line is the area under the curve, right? So we saw this. This is why Farrell's introduction was perfect. You get a pretty good measurement if you're measuring every 2 days, and we all know that if you start measuring, well, like once a week, you get much bigger error. So here's your 24% under measuring if you miss that peak, and if you do like, so the guy who runs the crew next door to me, they used to sample every week, and then they started running out of money, and they started sampling every 2 weeks. So if you were sampling every 2 weeks, every about 13 days, and you happen to go out on Mondays, you're 37% under. But if you went out and sampled on Tuesdays instead, this will go, well, now you're 15% under. And if you went and sampled on Wednesdays instead, as was shown before, if you hit right on one of those peaks, you can really overestimate. And so here, the percent deviation of what you would estimate from the real, you're 83% over. So there's a big difference just what day of the week you choose to sample, right? If you're sampling infrequently. So here's a really simple idea, right? Between my committee meetings, I thought, well, we all kind of know, and many people in the session have already said, right? We go out when there's a rain, and we be sure to sample. And if we can, we get that tail of the downside, right? So we sample more frequently after a rain, and then we sample less frequently. Well, we're doing what we all know, that later in the season, there's less sampling, or there's less emissions. So wouldn't it be nice to sort of move some of those measurements that are out there in days 220 and 240 back to where the peak is and resolve the peak better? Well, okay, fine. And so as an old modeler and optimization guy, I think, well, we'll just optimize it, right? Well, you can't really, because you just saw as you shift one day. So what you see on the left is the root sum square error, right, between the real measurements. And it's just up and down, and it's all over, right? There's no gradient. You can't do a gradient search because you shift just a little bit and you're overestimating. You shift just a little bit and you're underestimating, right? You can't do traditional optimization. And so that's sort of what that curve is down there on the right, shows you what the minimum was. And you also notice that it just happened to be minimum, right? Because you've missed the peak, but you've caught those little valleys. So the things sort of balance out, and you're only 4% deviation, even though you're not really measuring the signal very much at all, right? So gradient search just doesn't work. So another simple idea. Well, that's what genetic algorithms are sort of good for. So I've got a mini tutorial here, which I'll try to just zip through. But So genetic algorithms, the essence of it is that they're mimicking natural selection, right? So instead of starting with one point and trying to move around, you just choose a whole bunch of points. And in this case, that's a pattern of sampling, right? So a whole bunch of different days of sampling. And then you take some of the characteristics from each of the parents and make a new sampling routine. And then, so that's the crossover to produce children. And then you do mutations, right? So you're going to get out of those holes, those local minima. So you just keep randomly sampling things, and then you calculate the fitness, and so you retain some of the characteristics of the best ones. So here are some of the things that it does for you. You start with this whole population. You can keep the good information from the previous. You don't have to have anything like a gradient or an objective function. I mean, all you need is the objective function. You don't need derivatives, gradients. And you don't need continuous functions. And in this case, you very much don't have a continuous function. And then, of course, the bottom one in whatever color that is, the solution isn't really unique, right? Because there may be a best answer, but there's lots of other answers that are really close, right? And you don't have any way to sort of get to the real bottom of the bowl. But hopefully you get a population of really good answers that are all really similar. So that was my other idea. Let's try doing some genetic optimization. So these are data actually from Tim Parkin, and there were a whole bunch of years. I just plotted three because if I put 10 on there, you won't be able to see anything. But what you see is the algorithm, my first attempt, I just thought, well, we'll just let it go, right? I mean, it'll just keep trying sampling until it comes up with a pattern that really works. Well, no, really, it can put a whole bunch in random places. And again, the peaks and the valleys kind of balance each other out, and it says the error is zero, but there's no rhyme or reason, really, to the answer. Well, okay, so let me try something slightly more intelligent, which is everybody already does this smart stuff, right? They say, yeah, don't try to make too much sense of that for a second. They already say, well, when it rains, we go out and sample. Well, all right, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to do weighting that says, well, if it has just rained above a certain size, and I'm going to let the genetic algorithm figure out what that size is. And we all know that when we fertilize, there's going to be peaks. So, and then it's going to go down with time after that, right, the likelihood of emissions. So I'm going to let the algorithm choose these weightings that are driven by events that we really understand, like tillage and fertilization and rain events. And so here is, if we say, well, there's some chance of emissions at all time, so the weighting across the bottom is just a horizontal line, and I integrate that, I get that sloping line at the top, and then if I interpolate backwards from that, I get those sampling periods across the bottom, which are the number of days. So that's what a uniform weighting gives you, a uniform sampling, right, is what I've just shown you. But then, if I let there be weighting, well, okay, and if I sample those data, that's how that weighting gets me those samples, right, from just as we've seen before. So now I let there be weighting like this. So when there's a rain event, there's some sort of a peak, and there's that fancy little wave that's described by four parameters that'll let that wave be taller and longer and steeper. I can get a whole bunch of shapes, right? So there's four parameters that describe that. Then there's sort of a decay function with time. So there's a peak, well, there's a big, basically a triangle that describes fertilization with a decay rate after that. And so in this example where I'm just looking at the little peaks for event, rain events, so you see a rain event at the bottom, and the algorithm's going to get to choose what the threshold is, right? Is it a half an inch rain, or is it 3/4 of an inch rain? And this will absolutely vary with location, right? Because what's your soil type, what's your drainage? But for a given location, my theory is I can create an optimal sampling time for Saskatchewan, or one field in Saskatchewan. So then you can see how this works, that the peaks get integrated, and when I interpolate backwards on that top graph, you get a bunch more sampling, right, where that peak was that went with that rain event, and then farther out, just after day 100, similarly, but a little less because of the decay function. So here is, in fact, running that algorithm for those data that we saw earlier. And you can see the rain events across the bottom, and you can see how the weighting follows from that, decaying with the rain events, and fertilization, which isn't shown here, I'm sorry. And you get that weighting at the top, and that leads you to this sort of a sampling. And oh, it's pretty good, right? I mean, 6%, and it catches those peaks. But you also notice all that sampling at the beginning that is fired up by these rain events, but really said the soil was kind of cool, right? And there really wasn't going to be a lot happening. Even though the things that I've built into the weighting function say to sample, well, but okay, so now I want to add in temperature as well. And then we know it isn't really rain, right? It's really water-filled pore space. So I can compute that with a simple sort of bucket model, right? So I'm going to keep building more and more of my wisdom of the system into this. You don't like that. No, exactly. So see, I don't need to give the rest of the talk. So I then said, okay, I need more data because I've got a lot of data, but... So we ran the descent model, which I admittedly is not right, but it's really representative, right? I mean, it may get the peak off by a day or two, but it gives us peaks when there are peaks and if it's calibrated. So I can run for 20 years, two soil textures, three N rates, and I can do it for trigger events like fertilization and rain and tillage. And then I can start building water-filled pore space and soil temperature and even soil nitrate, all the things that I could measure and I could use in a real campaign, right? And I really like the idea of the FTIR as like a canary, right, to tell me. That's even better than this, maybe. But, so, the answer then is I can build more. And so now I'm not going to show you more pictures because 20 years, two soil textures, and remember, it's all a function. If you start saying, how much better is it, it's all a function of which day did I sample in the uniform, right, that I'm trying to compare with. So it all becomes probabilistic. So I'm just going to wave my hands here. You'll have to wait for the paper when I make the pretty graphs. Wave my hands and say, this does indeed do a lot better job. Statistically, right? I mean, and it's exactly as you suggested, so that's where I'm going. Why not just use a model and use that model in a probabilistic way, right? So run your favorite model. Run descent. You're not really sure of the soil moisture and the soil texture. You know, so run all of those things for multiple times of the model. Run it up to the day that, you know, it is now in the year, and you can anticipate what future weather might look like, right? You know you have a budget, and you can have a probability of what the, you know, how much effort should you put into sampling today? And so that's basically kind of where my bottom line is. We can absolutely easily do better than uniform sampling. People already do, right? They do adaptive sampling, like after rain events. Building more and more knowledge into the system, we can do even better. I played around with a simple bucket model to put in the water-filled pore space instead of just looking at precip, and yes, of course it does better, but really, why don't we just use a model? And in fact, why don't we use a model with something like an FTIR? So these near-continuous systems like the one Jordy told you about and the one that Dr. Farrell told you about, they're a little expensive, and we're probably not going to put them everywhere, but if you've got a few of them out in the field, and so they're telling you almost in real time what the emissions are, and you combine that with some predictive modeling, I think we can really much, much better do our manual sampling than just sending the crew out every 7 days or whatever. And that's all I got.
We might have time for one quick question.
Yeah, I want to follow up on a reaction on the front. Mm-hmm. That the model is chasing the data as opposed to the data offering what the model is doing. And so if you have a model that believes that, you know, peaks are going to happen after the rain, or the peaks happen only after a high temperature, then you already know the system, why study it in the first place. But if you're blind and you don't know what's going to happen, and you're only sampling after the rain event, or you're only sampling after a high temperature event, then those are the only data you're going to see. You're obviously going to miss all the other peaks.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a self-processizing circle, or I don't know what it's called.
Well,
that was a short question, but the answer is not very short, so we might actually have to move on. Let me just say.
If I can do it quickly, basically we do have a bunch of knowledge and people already are using it, right? We go out and sample intelligently because we know there's been rain, we know there's been fertilization, and the model is, if you run it probabilistically, is doing nothing more than that. It's just combining many things that we can't do in our brain as we're driving out to the field, right?
I drive to the field, I know the road already. But the question is, can I use this for a situation that I'm totally blind about?
Yeah. Well, so I would say you're never totally blind. You do know.
Okay, well, thank you very much.